Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. The creator of such classics as The Cat in the Hat was born 100 years ago, but he's still among the most beloved of children's authors. Less well known is that he never had any children of his own, that he took on Adolf Hitler during World War II, and that, as our guest this week writes, he was in many ways the quiet outsider he often portrayed in his books. Our guest is Philip Nell, the author of Dr. Seuss, American Icon, and he'll be here in a few minutes. After that, John Fay will join us to give us his thoughts on what he calls the Seussentennial, and Fiona Beatty will check in with another of her sites of the week, once again, on Dr. Seuss. But first, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. Well, the good folks of Pittsfield, Massachusetts got into a tizzy just over 200 years ago, and it was over what turned into America's favorite pastime. That's right, baseball. It seems that in 1791, Pittsfield passed a law specifically prohibiting playing baseball within 80 yards of the Congregational Church, the newly built town structure in the town center, which also doubled as a public meeting house. The problem was that the players kept breaking very expensive glass windows. The news for historians was that it was further evidence that baseball had its start decades earlier than popularly believed and in a different location. Cooperstown, New York, home of the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, was long considered the birthplace of the game, and Abner Doubleday the father of the sport. But after a number of document findings, both site and sire were downgraded to mythic status. Ted Spencer, vice president of the Hall of Fame and its chief curator, readily acknowledged that Cooperstown isn't the place where baseball began, but he believes that will not diminish the romance and allure of Cooperstown. He believes that the game originated in several places simultaneously. And according to a recent report by the BBC, surgeons were carrying out more complicated skull operations in the 11th century than previously believed. A skull belonging to a 40-year-old peasant of that period, discovered at a site near Yorkshire, England, provides evidence that the man survived an otherwise fatal blow to the head thanks to such surgery. He was struck in the head by a blunt weapon, causing a severely depressed fracture in his skull. But he was given life-saving surgery, which lifted the depressed bone and relieved pressure on the brain. Roman and Greek writings document the technique, but there's no mention of it in Anglo-Saxon literature for centuries thereafter. Some historians theorize that Western Europe was deprived of such surgical knowledge after the fall of Alexandria in the 7th century for at least 600 years. The discovery, however, provides evidence that it was performed at least 100 years earlier. That the procedure was performed on a peasant also raised questions, as it was a medical treatment affordable only to the wealthy. This has led historians to conclude that it was performed by an itinerant healer whose medical knowledge was handed down through oral tradition. Yet to come, an interview with Phil Nell on Dr. Seuss, a commentary on Seussentennial, and our Seuss site of the week, all on the 100th anniversary of his birth. You're listening to Talking History.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel. Monster, Mr. Grinch, your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders. You've got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch. I wouldn't touch you with a 39.5-foot pole.
Dr. Seuss, the master of nonsensical rhyme and verse and the creator of such classics as The Cat in the Hat and green eggs and ham, was born 100 years ago, but he still reigns supreme as one of the most beloved and influential children's authors and illustrators of the 21st century. And he's the subject of a new book, Dr. Seuss, American Icon, by Philip Nell. Nell is a professor of English at Kansas State University. He's also the author of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter's novels, A Reader's Guide. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Theodore Seuss Geisel, born on March 2, 1904, Springfield, Massachusetts, not far from where I grew up. Take it from there. Tell us what we should know about his childhood.
Well, he was the son of Theodore Robert Geisel, who was a brewer, and of the former Henrietta Seuss, and his real name was Theodore Seuss Geisel. Two important things about his childhood would be that as the son of German immigrants, his grandparents came from Germany, he was teased at the beginning of World War I when German Americans found themselves under fire at home. And also when he went to college, another thing happened which I think is influential in his career, and that is that not a single fraternity invited him to pledge at Dartmouth, where he went to college, because it was thought that he was Jewish. And that led him to join the humor magazine.
He wasn't Jewish.
No, he wasn't.
Okay.
But I think that those incidents are the kind of incidents that will shape a man who grows up to write books that are critical of prejudice. You know, being teased for his ethnicity and for his presumed religion leads him to grow up to write books like The Sneetches and Horton Hears a Who. So those would be two incidents from his childhood, I think, that would be important.
Okay, now earlier in the year, there was a lot of literature, articles, propaganda, perhaps, out of Springfield, Massachusetts, claiming them as his own. Is there anything important about his being raised in Springfield that we should know about him?
Well, sure. The architecture in his books borrows from Springfield's architecture. It also borrows from La Jolla's architecture, which is where he lived most of his adult life. The zoo. He spent time at the zoo drawing the animals, and the animals didn't come out looking exactly like zoo animals, as you might imagine, but that's an important influence in his life from Springfield as well.
Okay. Now, he grows up, he marries twice, but he has no children.
Right.
Yet he becomes probably one of the most famous writers of children's books, certainly of our age, of mm-hmm. all time. Do you think there's any influence with the fact that he didn't have any children on his writing?
Well, when reporters asked him that question, he would always say, "You make him, I'll amuse him." But I think that joke may conceal some deeper feelings. His first wife, Helen, couldn't have children, and when friends bragged about their children, he and Helen would talk about their imaginary daughter, Chrysanthemum Pearl, who, you know, was quite a remarkable daughter of theirs, and even would include her on Christmas cards as kind of a joke. But I don't think that wasn't entirely just a joke. He dedicates his second book to Chrysanthemum Pearl, aged 89 months, going on 90. So I think his absence of children may have been an influence. I think even more, perhaps, it's that he remembered his childhood into his adulthood and was able to use that. So
Chrysanthemum Pearl, what a great name.
Yeah.
So when did Theodore Seuss Geisel become Dr. Seuss?
Well, during the spring of 1925, when he was a senior at Dartmouth and was editor of the college humor magazine, he and some of his friends were caught drinking gin in his room, and they were punished because it was Easter weekend and it was during Prohibition, and so he was forbidden to continue to edit or contribute to the college humor magazine Jack-O-Lantern. And so he contributed anyway. He just used different names. L. Pasteur, D.G. Rossetti, Class of 25, T. Seuss and Seuss, and that's the first time that he takes Seuss, his mother's maiden name and his middle name, as his pseudonym. And then a couple of years later, as a magazine cartoonist, he adopts the Doctor, first as Dr. Theophrastus Seuss, and then just as Dr. Seuss.
Interesting. You mentioned earlier, this is kind of ironic, he was ridiculed because he was a German around the time of World War I, and people accused him of being Jewish when he wasn't.
Right.
And yet, just prior to World War II and during World War II, he takes on Adolf Hitler and is, let's just say, quite critical of him. Tell us about that.
Yeah, in fact, before the United States entered the war, Seuss was very worried because he knew that we were going to be involved in this war, and he was worried that we weren't prepared because isolationist sentiment at home was leading people astray. And so he began publishing cartoons in the left-wing New York newspaper PM. In fact, he published over 400 of these between April of 1941 and January of 1943, and they were anti-fascist cartoons. They were critical of anti-Semitism. They were critical of racism. They were critical of isolationism. And this is Seuss at his most raw, his most provocative. It's Seuss wearing his politics on his sleeve. It was really an important time for his work because he uses his art to change people's minds. And it's a direct line from there to books like Yertle the Turtle, which he said was inspired by the rise of Hitler. I mean, it's probably the most popular anti-fascist book ever written. Or books like The Sneetches, which was inspired by his opposition to anti-Semitism. So, a very important time in his life.
Was he a liberal for most of his life, his political philosophy?
Yeah, he was a liberal Democrat. He voted Democrat.
Okay. You write that he was, in many ways, the quiet outsider. He often portrayed in his books an underdog who endures ridicule for his eccentricities, but someone who triumphs in the end. Great line. What does it mean?
Well, it means a number of things, but I think the best way to explain that would be to recount a story from his high school art class when he was drawing a picture, and he turned the picture upside down. Because, although he didn't realize it at the time, if the picture looks wrong upside down, it will also look wrong right side up. You can check the balance by turning it upside down. Well, his teacher came over and said, "Theodore, real artists don't turn their pictures upside down." Instinctively, the young Ted Geisel knew that they did, and he got up and walked out of that art class, never to return, and never to really have any formal education as an artist. And of course, he got the last laugh, didn't he? He made his fame, his name, and his money as an artist, first an advertising artist, and then as the writer of children's books. So that's one explanation of that line.
Seminal moment in his life.
Yeah, it really was. Or at least he looked back on it that way.
Sure, right. Yeah. Your introduction is titled, How to Read Dr. Seuss. Now, I doubt many people even thought about that, thinking how difficult can it be to read Dr. Seuss. So let's talk about that a bit. Let's start with one of his better-known books, and if we have a chance, we'll do more than one. But let's do The Cat in the Hat to start with.
Well, how should we read Dr. Seuss? We should read him as an artist, a poet, and a provocateur. Most people don't take his poetry seriously because he's writing for children, and because the meter in which he writes is the same meter as the limerick. It's anapests is what he uses most of the time. It's actually also the same meter as The Night Before Christmas. So that's one way. Read him as a poet. And it's very hard to write not only poetry, but to write using a limited vocabulary. The Cat in the Hat has only 225 different words because it's designed to teach children to read, and you don't want to include too many words to confuse them. So that's in verse, and it has a limited vocabulary, which I think is really quite remarkable. And if you look at the book, I mean, look at the drafts of it, you can see that he worked very hard to get the verse just right. Well, how about the art? As an artist, Seuss synthesizes 20th century styles into his own style, Seussism. You can see cartoonists like George Harriman's Crazy Cat, Rube Goldberg, but also the influence of surrealism, of Art Nouveau, of Cubism in his work, and mixes that into his own unique, energetic cartoon surrealism, Seussism. So that's another way to read him. And, of course, as a provocateur, to come back to The Cat in the Hat, the book ends like this. It ends with the cat having cleaned everything up. Mom comes home, asks, "What did you do today?" And it ends like this. The children say, should we tell her about it? Now, what should we do? Well, what would you do if your mother asked you? Open question. Do you tell your mother a lie, which she'll believe there was no cat? Or do you tell her the truth, which she won't believe? And I like that. He does that in a lot of his books. He leaves it open, puts the question to the reader. So
great. Very good. What about Green Eggs and Ham?
Well, Green Eggs and Ham is a fun story behind that, too. His publisher, Bennett Cerf, bet him that he couldn't write a book using 50 or fewer words. And Green Eggs and Ham was the result. It has 50 words in it, exactly. And it's his bestseller, too, incidentally. Green Eggs and Ham is the top-selling Seuss book.
Tell us how it's provocative. How's the provocateur come through in it?
Well, the provocateur comes through in that one because you might think, standard kind of lesson. Try something new. Try Green Eggs and Ham. How do you know you won't like it if you haven't tried it? But notice that it's the small character who's delivering that lesson to the large character. The child is lecturing the adult here. In Seuss's books, he often places faith in the child. The child will be the person who is the agent of change, who can challenge the status quo. Adults don't get it. So that's the provocateur side there. He takes the side of the child. And the children, are the future, really. Children can change things.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit, because I didn't know this myself, that he wrote an adult book. Tell us about the adult book.
Yes, The Seven Lady Godivas. It was published in 1939, and it was a flop. the premise is that there's not one Lady Godiva, but seven. And each of the Lady Godivas, or Ladies Godiva, is engaged to one of the brothers peeping. There's peeping Tom, peeping Dick, peeping Harry, peeping Sylvester, peeping Frelinghuysen, and so on. Well, anyway, Lord Godiva dies. He's killed in a horse accident, and the sisters Godiva, the ladies Godiva, decide that they will not marry until each of them has discovered a horse truth. And so they learn things like, don't put the cart before the horse, and you can lead a horse to water, but can't make him drink. Kind of the gag cartoon material that he was writing a lot at the time, which sounds fairly innocent, except that all of the ladies Godiva are completely naked. However, imagine Dr. Seuss drawing naked women. These are perhaps the least erotic women ever depicted anywhere.
Well, that explains why it failed. So
yes, okay. Yes, it does. Seuss attributed his failure to that. He said, quote, I attempted to draw the sexiest babes I could, but they came out looking absurd. I think I got their ankles wrong. They're funny, but as an adult book, it doesn't really succeed with the adult content, as it were.
Okay, what about the musical, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T?
Also a flop, I'm afraid, but a much more interesting flop. In this one, Bart Collins, played by Tommy Rettig, who would play Timmy in the TV show Lassie, hates piano lessons. And Dr. Terwilliger teaches him piano, and he has this nightmare of a kind of piano prison camp where all these boys are enslaved to play Dr. Terwilliger's massive piano. And it's a visually very dark and very Seussian movie in its sets and in its look. But, yeah, Seuss more or less disowned that. It came out in, I think, 1953, and it has sort of a cult following now, but he didn't feel it quite lived up to his standards. But I think it's a lot of fun.
Okay, sounds it. Okay, you conclude the book by commenting on Seuss and calling him an American icon and an American iconoclast.
Right. He is an icon of children's literature. He is hailed by members of both parties, Democrats, Republicans, as this great American, teaches children to read, funny books. And yet, of course, he's also something of a subversive, something of an iconoclast. He wrote the Butter Battle Book, for example, to challenge Ronald Reagan's escalation of the nuclear arms race. He wrote The Lorax as a pro-environmentalist book critiquing the way people exploit the environment. So he's taken as this icon, as this figure really embraced by all Americans, and yet he actually has an edge to him. So that's why I say icon and iconoclast, and I also think that's a uniquely American kind of characteristic, that we celebrate the rebel, the iconoclast. And yet, of course, we live by laws, and we're not in a constant state of revolt. And he embodies that kind of paradox of the American character in being icon and iconoclastic at the same time.
Okay, well, that's where we'll end it, but you must be very pleased. And this book's gotten a lot of play, and it's certainly well written, so congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and thanks so much for having me on the program.
You're welcome. I've been talking with Philip Nell, author of Dr. Seuss, American Icon, published this year by Continuum Publishing. This is Talking History.
Rot, 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 rot. It's a plot, 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 plot. We're the Wickersham Brothers. We're on to your plot. Pretending you're talking to who's who are not. It's a deep, tight, evil, political plot. Pretending you're talking to who's who are not. We're the Wickersham Brothers. We're vigilant spotters. Hot shot spotters of rotters and plotters. And we're going to save our sons and our daughters from you. You're a dastardly, dastardly, schnastardly schnook. Trying to brainwash our brains with his gobbling hook.
Welcome back. Continuing on the 100th anniversary of Dr. Seuss's birth, John Fay reflects on the human values that underlay Seuss's whimsical and beloved tales. Fay is a professor of history at Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania.
Theodore Geisel was born 100 years ago this year. Writing under the name Dr. Seuss, Geisel unveiled to millions of children the values that have defined the human experience. Random House, the publisher of most of his books, has proclaimed 2004 the Seuss Centennial, a year-long commemoration of Geisel's work. Geisel's books have expanded our imagination, encouraged our sense of self-worth, and challenged us to make the world and our local communities better places. They've also reminded us that the ideals of freedom, individualism, and liberty have always existed in tension with community, restraint, and personal sacrifice. Born in Springfield, Massachusetts, Geisel spent most of his life writing from his home in La Jolla, California. He and his first wife, Helen, did not have children, but his books, filled with bold characters, exotic colors, and wacky storylines, made him the 20th century's most popular children's author. Until his death in 1991, Geisel wrote children's fiction that reflected his commitment to human values. Oh, the Places You'll Go, for example, reads like a sermon on self-improvement and mobility. Seuss provided a lesson against racial discrimination in The Sneetches, while The Cat in the Hat, the book that won Geisel international fame, challenges the conformist tendencies of middle-class suburbia. Seuss was also willing to be more straightforward in his social commentary. The Butter Battle Book is a stinging criticism of the nuclear arms race, and The Lorax alerts us to the environmental consequences of capitalism. Geisel seemed to realize that individualism, while essential to any democratic society, was often not sufficient to sustain the kind of community needed for a republic to survive. For example, a belief in personal self-betterment, as celebrated in Oh, the Places You'll Go, can easily degenerate into a form of crass self-indulgence. Such is the case with the Onceler, the greedy capitalist of the Lorax, who, in his quest to leave home for better pastures, ends up destroying the environment through his pursuit of industrial wealth. Similarly, when we are off to great places, off and away, we're often going there at the expense of the local communities we leave behind. Dr. Seuss reminds us that when self-improvement and pursuits of happiness are defined entirely by social and geographic mobility, we can never truly care for natural and human places as the Lorax challenges us to do. It's precisely because of these long-standing tensions between individualism and community that the writings of Theodore Geisel have had an enduring appeal. Dr. Seuss remains a window into the deepest convictions and paradoxes of human life. We can only hope that his books will continue to help children of all ages make sense of themselves and their obligations to society.
You've been listening to John Fay, professor of history at Messiah College and a writer for the History News Service. And when we return, Fiona Beatty tells us about a museum exhibit celebrating the Seuss Centennial. This is Talking History.
This is the story of Gerald McCloy and the strange thing that happened to that little boy. And they say it all started when Gerald was 2. That's the age kids start talking, at least most of them do. Well, when he started talking, they say, in his case, when the time came for words to come out of his face, Gerald, they say, sat up straight in his bed, and he looked at his folks, and you know what he said? He didn't talk words, he went instead.
The 100th anniversary of Dr. Seuss is being recognized far and wide, and to mark the event, there'll be several special events, like the museum exhibit Fiona Beatty is here to tell you about.
From there to here, from here to there, funny things are everywhere, and that is just what you'll find if you go to the Children's Museum of Manhattan, New York, to the O. Seuss Off to Great Places exhibition. You have brains in your head, you have feet in your shoes, you can steer yourself any direction you choose. It's an adventure into the world of Seussian places for old and young alike, featuring Theodore Geisel's sketches of manuscripts and 25 interactive activity areas based on several of his books. If you've ever wanted to teeter on the tightrope in the Circus McGurkus or put the Thrum Dibulator back together, now is the opportunity. As for the mighty Borfin, this construction of tubes and cylinders rises daily and unschlumps at the close of day. You can add your own story with sounds, words, and pictures from the Sneetches and post it on the interactive Sneetch graffiti wall, live on the internet, either from home or at the museum. O. Seuss, Off to Great Places, will remain open at the Children's Museum through August 2005, when it will begin a 3-year national tour. To find out more, go to www.cmom.org. If you never did, you should. These things are fun, and fun is good.
Look at that turtle go, bro.
I'm a Bowie Islander, the son of my son. You know the territory was a king of the pond. A nice little pond, it was clean, it was neat. The lobster was warm, there was a plenty to eat. Until one day, the king of the mob decided the king, and he was room was too small. I'm a ruler of all that I see. I got my love, and that's the trouble with me.
I'm too low down, not to knock the down. I want a place to be on. So you're to the turd, the king lifted his hand, and a bitch of the turd, the king gave a command. He ordered all the turds on the one another's back. He piled them high into a tent to the back. Oh, you're to the turd, of the things I now look. I'm a king of a cloud, or I'm a king of a mule.
And what happened then? Well, in Whoville, they say that the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day. And then the true meaning of Christmas came through, and the Grinch found the strength of 10 Grinches plus 2. And now that his heart didn't feel quite so tight, he whizzed with his load through the bright morning light. With a smile in his soul, he descended Mount Crumpet, cheerily blowing hoo-hoo on his trumpet. He rode into Whoville, he brought back their toys, he brought back their floof to the Who girls and boys. He brought back their snoof and their tringlers and fuzzles. Brought back their pantookas, their dafflers and wuzzles. He brought everything back, all the food for the feast. And he himself, the Grinch, carved the roast beast. Welcome, Christmas. Bring your cheer. Cheer to all who's far and near. Christmas Day is in our grasp, so long as we have hands to clasp. Christmas Day will always be just as long as we have we. Welcome Christmas while we stand, heart to heart and hand in hand.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beattie producer, Alex Smith our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu. Or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.